Thank you very much for inviting me here, Deborah. And it's a delight to be exhibiting in the new art gallery, Walthall. I want to speak about this work in particular, and whilst I speak about this, refer to my general practice as an artist, specifically to my interest in visual narrative and drawing. This exhibition, Danton Drink, drawings of the British drinking, came about when Deborah visited my gallery in London, Hales Gallery, to see an exhibition called Menageries and Monuments, which was about how public buildings represent the beliefs of the society who create them. And this was a series of similarly large drawings that showed public buildings such as the Vienna State Library and John Lewis in London, but they all had encyclopedic information superimposed on them, such as the table of the elements or the evolution of species. And I think that Deborah was impressed by the volume of work and the the engagement.
Yeah,
with,
there's so much to look at in each work.
With information that appeared in the work. Mm. So when she invited me to do a show at the New Art Gallery Walthall, I initially was looking around for possible locations where I could set drawings about a particular theme. And Walthall is an unusual town because it's a bit more disjointed than others. There didn't seem to be a central square or a civic heart to it. But whilst I was looking around and sketching the buildings in Walthall, I noticed these banners hanging from all the lampposts. And I thought initially, oh, that's going to be advertising a festival or a carnival, but they didn't. The banners were saying, antisocial behaviour will not be tolerated. You will receive an ASBO if you're caught drunk in the town centre. And I thought this is very unusual, but it's familiar to all of us who observe the media and listen to the politicians, how binge drinking is portrayed as a kind of dangerous epidemic in Britain. I thought I wasn't necessarily singling out Walthall as a town that was struck by this problem, but I thought it would be a nice way of looking at a particular geographic environment and an aspect of British culture that might lead into observations about British society in general through the lens or kind of view through the bottom of the glass of the British relationship with alcohol. And so, the first drawing, if we move over here, I'll talk in order of my making these drawings. I'll go around to the four pieces. But as in kind of previous exhibitions I've done, I like to find a geographic location where I can kind of set myself. And it's very much in the fine art tradition of the artist plonking themselves down with their easel in the middle of the landscape. And from that single viewpoint, watching society pass by them. Once I'd come up with this idea of dealing with drink and the British as a subject, I usually kind of gather lots of reading material and read about the history of the subject or go through the newspapers to find out exactly how they're portraying this. So I read lots of reports from the House of Commons about drink legislation. And I read studies on the changing attitudes towards alcoholism and also the history of British society as drink has affected it. Wars, revolutions, how drink is used to coerce people and to control them. I found my location in the, what's it called? The market? No, the bridge.
Which
is where the market is at the moment. And the gymnasium there, I think it's called the ISIS Gym.
Yeah, it used to be LA Fitness, but I'm not sure where it is now.
They let me kind of sit in one of their windows up there and draw for a day. And so I came up with this kind of traditional central kind of vanishing point perspective view of the town centre. And as I was drawing this, it kind of struck me that the layout of the buildings kind of almost corresponded exactly to a painting that's in the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna by Peter Bruegel called The Fight Between Carnival and Lent, which shows the oppositional forces of these two religious holidays, depicted literally as kind of battling figures. And
there are postcards.
And as it kind of corresponded with some of the reading I was doing about the, especially in Victorian Britain, the temperance movement, who followed the Americans' lead with the Maine laws that prohibited the use and sale of alcohol in certain states in America, they went about addressing drink as a serious social problem through attempting to legislate against its sale, and through groups such as the Methodists and the Quakers, encouraging people to sign pledges promising not to to drink. So in a similar fashion as Bruegel has these two oppositional forces of Carnival and Lent, I took a flowchart I've been making about the temperance movement and the various figures and how they connected up to each other, how members of the Methodist community would put members forward for Parliament so they could start lobbying on behalf of the temperance societies to have a repeal of the drink laws and eventually kind of prohibition in Britain. That was their intention. Some were more zealous than others, but so you'll see figures here. This is the Royal Commission on the sale of liquor here. But on top of this flowchart, I overlaid figures that are all taken from the marks of drinks bottles, like liquor bottles. So the flowchart that I'd created is shown as a disturbed narrative, as all of these figures from the temperance movement are interrupted by the liquor logos that we're familiar with today. So you'll see these ladies from the British Women's Temperance Association being besieged by Smirnoff logos. And here are Mexican figures from a tequila bottle kind of making graffiti from a Tanqueray gin and various other liquor bottles. Whilst the Quakers here have been stomped on by the flamenco dancers from a Spanish liqueur. So it's mixing the familiar with the historical. So I think people would be more familiar with the figures from the liquor bottles than they would from this kind of rather arcane history of the temperance movement, which has kind of completely died out, and did kind of, they failed in all their attempts to control the sale of liquor to the extent they wanted to in the United Kingdom.
Where did you get the Band of Hope
from? Oh, the Band of
Hope.
Oh, right, yes. The Band of Hope.
I think
my
father signed the pledge for me.
Oh,
right.
Oh, there's a couple in there. The local history centre. Yeah. Yeah.
But they were very important in the temperance movement, and they spread across the whole country. Opening, yeah. But they've kind of metamorphosized into a. The Hope House story exists.
Is it?
I think it's in Manchester, and they counsel young people who have problems with drug addiction. Rather than alcoholism, but they were connected to the Sunday schools. But no, in the cabinets in here, in this resource room, there are a couple of small pledges there.
And you've mentioned that the borders on the works as well.
The borders that I've used for all of the four drawings I've lifted from these Victorian, kind of highly decorated, beautifully printed temperance pledge certificates. And then in these roundels here, I include photographic material that I've collected in the process of making the drawings. But I hope in my explanation I've been able to, you know, there are lots of different levels to my engagement with making a single drawing. There's kind of the reading, the photographic material being out there sketching. And the traditional perspectival systems.
You mentioned Bruegel as being one artist, and we've got this little room here that you can see examples of some of the artists who forms some of the artistic tradition, I suppose, that you engage with. But Cruikshank also, who we have the
print, we haven't
one,
mentioned
was kind
him.
Of a,
yes.
a key
yeah.
a key image, yeah, I suppose.
Cruikshank was a famous satirical artist and cartoonist of the 19th century who, I think he had a drink problem, and he was converted to teetotalism by John Bright, I think, the liberal politician. Mm. And his project was to educate the British working classes as to the evils of drink. And he made a huge painting about twice the size of these called The Worship of Bacchus, which showed Bacchus as a central figure and showed the same. I think you've got the print
yeah,
in there.
Yeah, the print
you?
Of it is in this room here. So you
but it shows there in kind of in narrative form the various evil effects of drink, and he shows what a society could be like if they were teetotal, and what happens, you know, the slippery slope. But the Victorians are very much into portraying the slippery slope, and had a belief in, you know, self-improvement, and that if someone was failing, it was their own, it wasn't society, it was their own personal fault. They could lift themselves out of poverty and their conditions, which is completely different to the attitude nowadays.
Yeah.
Where drink is treated as a kind of, well, an illness, really. Alcoholism is treated as a personal illness. But Cruikshank used to tour this painting, The Worship of Bacchus, around the Band of Hope halls and Methodist halls. And he'd hang the canvas on the wall and deliver a very dry lecture about the evils of drink, hoping to convert people to his cause afterwards. But I don't think there's any record of anyone being converted at all. Because it was, you know, very much part of Victorian working class life to find your solace and your entertainment in the bars rather than in a tea room. Mm-hmm. And aspects of that as part of Victorian society shown here, where these ladies who would have set up tea houses in the docks to try and lure the dockers out of the pubs and into a much more kind of genteel environment, kind of completely unsuitable to the life of the docker. They're being kind of attacked by Captain Morgan rum logos. But there's obviously quite a there's a comical element to the drawings as well. It's slapstick, but
exactly, yeah. You just don't, every time you go and look at it, you always find another detail that you didn't spot. You know,
what I liked about this kind of form of this way of working is the ability I have to for the viewer to encounter the drawing on a very in a subjective fashion by the way that they you navigate the drawing.
It's very architectural. If you've got a background.
No, I did train as a draftsman with, you know, parallel motion drawing boards. But my background's in fine art and printmaking, really. But it's using the public space as, you know, as a theatre that it's my interest in architecture. I think I'm quite good at drawing it as well. But I like the fact that the viewer can encounter the drawing and the narrative in a fashion that only this kind of tableau drawing can present. Mm-hmm. Unlike kind of film, where you're led through a narrative and you have the director telling you things, which you either pick up on or you don't.
With Adam's work, it's so difficult to encounter his work properly in reproduction form, because of course when the scale is really important to them, the way that you look at it, the viewer, and the way that you navigate it. You can't take the whole thing in at once. You have to kind of scan around the whole thing looking for details. And when it gets squeezed right down for reproduction purposes, you kind of lose much of the narrative, don't you? So you can't really see what's going on in them anymore. So it's kind of interesting, an interesting challenge, wasn't it?
Yes. We produced a book.
Hopefully you've seen it. That's downstairs as well.
So as I was doing this drawing, I was making lots of notes about how the exhibition would take shape and how the drawings would relate to each other. And I came up with the idea of having, you know, this drawing represent the political aspect of drink in Britain. Because the Temperance was very much a political movement as well as it being a religious one. And then The other, there's a drawing over here that I that represents the place of drink in the British language. Yeah. And then the drawing here represents the place of drink according to the royal family and British society. And the one over there just shows the changing face of the venues of drinking. Mm-hmm. This drawing shows, well, this is my studio here, which is in East London, near Liverpool Street Station. And it's a neighbourhood that's become kind of infested with art galleries and bars and cocktail lounges. So this isn't dissimilar to a usual Friday or Saturday night. It's called Club Row. It's where an animal market used to take place in the 1970s. Brick Lane Market is up that way, which is a famous second-hand market. But I was collecting various synonyms and figures of speech for drunkenness in English, and I came up with the idea of just literally, well, Bruegel's painting, the Flemish Proverbs, does a similar thing, which I've kind of lifted and used for my drawing. He represented Flemish Proverbs literally for comic effect, which was the kind of humour that in the 16th century would have been familiar. So I decided to do the same thing with all of these British figures of speech for drinking, which are all kind of rather fruity and kind of disgusting, a lot of them really. But, I thought by doing this, just by having a whole encyclopedia of them as a street scene of drunkenness and debauchery, it would give one a picture of how the British view themselves and their relationship to drink. So you have all sorts. And around the edge, this border, I took self-portraits of pulling faces according to the 11 stages of drunkenness, which I don't know if it, I think it's a Japanese thing originally, where they describe someone's the 12 steps you go through before complete annihilation. Yeah. So it kind of starts at the top where it's you're charming and everyone's laughing at you all the way around to being kind of a real Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde type character. So you'll see, so first of all, when I was making this drawing, I made lots of sketches of the buildings around my neighbourhood and arranged this kind of perspectival system as a kind of matrix onto which to put all of these figures of speech. And then it was a case of working through an alphabetical list of them, really, and making each of these figures of speech kind of link up with others and coming up with different ways of representing them, some of which I omitted some of them because they're impossible to put in there. But I think there must be, there's several hundred in here. So you'll see, this is one from Shakespeare in England, where people are described as being foxed when they've had too much ale. So this gent here is being consumed by foxes. And underneath the wheelie bin where these figures are literally trashed. And I forget what this is, steaming. These people are on a kind of a hot air vent, steam pigged. But it becomes a challenge.
Oliver Twist.
Yeah, that's Cockney rhyming slang. As is
Doc Cotton.
Is Cockney rhyming slang. Yeah.
You pick out some more.
But I like the idea. Yeah. You're encountering something visual, but you're trying to find your way around it. Using language.
And amazing that we've got such colourful language. It just says something about our society, doesn't it? The fact we have so many terms and phrases.
And I limited it to the English language, obviously, because it shows about the British and drinking. But I think I asked, there was a Spanish designer, works for Fraser, who did say that there weren't as many phrases in Spanish.
Oh, really? Because you went right back as far as the 17th century as well.
Some good lists
some old ones as well.
Phrases for drunkenness in the... Yes, it is 17th century. This one...
Bitten by a barn weasel?
That's bitten by a barn weasel, I think, which is 17th century English. This one's he had seen the French king, is another phrase. And there are some of them are quite long. He has, there's one here's gone something, something. He has got himself indentured. they all refer to you know, 17th century society and what people's jobs at the time and what they were doing and how they, the relationship to their employer, all sorts of odd things about British society.
And at Walsall, reference again, Highgate Brewery here.
But I could go through them all and let you know what each one is, but I like the idea of, you know, it's the encoding of this information visually.
What are
the hula hoops?
I think most people, well, most members of staff.
Oh, this hula hoop lady. Oh, that one's spangled, but she's wearing a spangly top. And I think there is something about hoops, but I can't remember what it is. Hooped? Some of them I'd never come across before, like this lady peeling a poster from a wall is Peely Wally. Peely Wally? Which I think is a Glaswegian term for drum. And I've included figures from Bruegel's painting Flemish proverbs in this, enacting these figures of speech. Oh, but this was supposed to be a kind of overweight Gordon Brown walking down the street here, and I have our local MP George Galloway shown here on a campaign. But his pamphlets are being torn up, which is another one here, and his partner is being lamped.
You said there were some more recognisable people.
There were, yes, Cherry Blair. Cherry
Blair
in a
shopping
trolley up there. Yeah. Trolleyed, obviously. But whilst I'm drawing it, sometimes I'm rendering the features of a figure and they start to look like someone familiar, so I'll exaggerate it until it becomes a sort of caricature.
Where do you start?
It is difficult to answer. Well, I arranged the perspective, and then there's a grid, so it's very much a system going on there. And it is very much a systematic process of drawing, rather than it being an expressive and intuitive process.
But as you're doing it, you must be finding other ideas as well. So a little bit on.
Yeah. There is an aspect of it kind of generating itself, but it's all underpinned by structure. And they're all done on I have a big drawing board on the wall with the paper stretched up on it that I can move around. But normally I'm drawing standing up and standing on a series of boxes in order to get to the top there. But the next step, should we have a look
at
this?
Should we get the real
I wanted to explore various theories about why drink was so important to the British people, because for many people coming to Britain for the first time, they're completely confused and shocked and, confounded by the fact that on a Saturday night or after work, the British won't go to a bar with their friends like the Italians would do and sit down and have some snacks and one Campari. They'll go to the pub and by 7 o'clock have had four or five pints and are on their way to kind of vomiting in the street on the way home before picking themselves up and having a kebab. And one of the theories I came across was it is to do with the subjugation of the British people as subjects of the royal family, and that it's a way of releasing the frustrations of a revolutionary spirit without overthrowing your rulers. It's a display of kind of hopelessness of your situation.
Resignation.
Yeah. So it's a form of release, which it refers to the tradition seen in the Bruegel painting of the carnival or the feast of fools, where the public have one day of release where the fool becomes the king and everything is inverted, and it allows the leaders to keep a cap on any dissent. But at the same time, there's always been a great interest from the rulers of Britain in the public's consumption of alcohol, because it's brought in an awful lot of revenue for the Chancellor, and the British people have fought wars on the back of beer, And in Shakespeare in England, there was a tradition of toasting, where if someone made a toast, you'd have to, I think they still do it in Russia, you have to respond and you have to drink. And people, some politicians tried to ban toasting in Britain in the 18th century, because they thought that's what was leading the British people to drink so much. So I thought I'd have this kind of, I depict the lineage of the British royal family according to their relationship with alcohol. And I'd have this procession taking place outside Buckingham Palace, which is adorned here with all of these flags showing the logos of drinks companies who have the seal of approval from the current monarch. Is that the royal warrant? Yeah. So they're allowed to show the royal warrant on their products. That's Bat 69. And so it starts here with William the Conqueror, and it kind of winds around as this kind of merry procession until we reach the present day, where we have the princes here enjoying this kind of champagne. I think it's champagne, vodka, and passion fruit. Slammer. They bang the glass and it bubbles and knock it back in one. With the attractive name of the crack baby, which they drink in nightclubs. I think they're not doing that anymore. So I didn't realise that William the Conqueror died of alcoholism, but they didn't obviously in the 11th century have such a thing as alcoholism. They had kind of concepts of gluttony, and William the Conqueror got incredibly fat. So I think one of his medic or his doctor, one of his advisors, said what you have to do is lock yourself in a room and consume nothing but alcohol. So he did this, and I think it was like maybe 3 or 4 months until he died. And he had one of those funerals similar to Henry VIII, where people couldn't bear to be in the chapel when he was being sent off because of the stench. And so you go through all of these, I think. People like, I think that's King Stephen, who as a young man used to get drunk and enjoy emptying his chamber pot over his brother's head, which kind of refers to the drunken revels of the Walsall teenager on a Saturday night, probably. Then this is, where are we here? I forget who it is. I think it's Edward II imported all of this Pinot Donis, particular fine claret from France. But the political element of the royal family and drink is evident in what they were drinking. Whereas when the British were at war with France, it wasn't popular, it wasn't patriotic to drink red Burgundy. You had to, and it wasn't good to drink. I think the British were at war with the Dutch as well, they wouldn't drink gin. So I think there was a point in London where the only drink it was considered fitting to consume was port, but it was drunk in the same fashion as drink beer, you'd have a pint of it. So I think if you consult lots of the writers of the time, like Johnson before he stopped drinking, and Samuel Pepys's diary, it's full of splitting headaches, all the days start with people having these splitting headaches, and epidemic of gout. That's Queen Anne here, who was, I think she was in a horrific state by the time she died. She couldn't walk because her feet were so riddled with gout because of her port consumption. But I think towards the end of her life, she was mostly bedridden, and she was carried around in a litter. And then there's Princess Margaret, everyone speaks about as a little bit of a drinker.
And Falstaff?
Sorry? Falstaff is in there as well, with Henry the Third and Henry the Fourth. Henry the Fifth and Henry the Fourth are in there with Falstaff, which is he's one of the great champions of drinking from British literature. And I think up until the Victorian era, people would always draw Falstaff or a Falstaffian character in paintings that depicted inns or drinking scenes. But I singled out Queen Victoria because of the relationship with this drawing about the temperance movement, which is born of the Victorian era, and drink being very much part of the Victorian era's kind of working person's life. But I've turned her into a kind of Bacchus figure, female Bacchus, providing this kind of plentiful supply of beer. Yeah. This is Richard III here, who I think he's inspired, I don't think he was a particularly big drinker, but he's inspired a drinking game that actors to this day play called Richard III.
Oh.
And there's some way where you're supposed to down a pint every time something's mentioned in the play.
So this is very loosely based on Crookshank.
Oh yes, the sky in the background is based on the smoke from the Victorian chimneys in the Crookshank painting.
And the French kind of battle.
The back of this figure here is taken from the Crookshank backers as well. And these figures that appear on the statue in front of Buckingham Palace are kind of pouring out wine instead of water. And the British Lion here has got this one's got his food bowl full of booze, and this one's got the bucket over its head. But it's like a carnival of excess, really. So, I mean, initially when I started to make the work for this exhibition, I thought that I spoke to people about the ideas for the show. I was quite surprised that people immediately assumed that I was going to be making some moral statement about the British and their relationship with drink. But I just wanted to not make a single point about it being a problem, and this is the solution to it. This is why it happens. I wanted to take it as a subject and just explore the various ways it's touched British life and history. Because British attitudes towards drink have been different successive centuries.
We're saying that you know, nowadays in the news what we hear about is kind of binge drinking and health-related issues to do with drinking and things like that, and the cost of the NHS and drink-related illnesses and so on. And there is a kind of antithesis to that, in a way, that the drinking culture in this country is very rich and it's quite complex, and there is a strong history there as well. And you only have to watch all your soap operas on TV to see that all the action takes place around the pubs and the bars and things like that, where all the community descends and all the comedy and tragedy then gets focused within those places. In a way that you've kind of created your own theatre within these images.
I think there's a lot of theatre to the way that the media represent drinking as a problem in Britain, and TV programmes portray cities as no-go areas at night, and there's a kind of vicarious entertainment value to that kind of media representation. For people who would fear being part of that madness. But maybe it's another depiction of the crowd and the individual's fear of the crowd and the experience of the crowd being very different as an observer than one who's swept up with the fervour of it all. Which is why I like to make, there's a parity between the drunken crowd on a Saturday night and the revolutionary mob who are out to kind of overturn society. Mm-hmm.
I was invited a few years ago to do a public art project in Reading, and it's stuck in my mind, this area, this part of Reading, which is another town that's quite lively on a Saturday night. They even have, I was really surprised, these pop-up urinals, and they come out of the pavement on Saturday night to stop people weeing against the church. But there's a part of it where there's like the river runs through a kind of an area where there are lots of bars on step levels, and I thought this is just like some kind of drinking coliseum here, where you can stand outside the bar and look down and all of this action is taking place, like at the Roman Coliseum. And so that was some time ago, but I always fancy doing a drawing of this place in Reading as a kind of coliseum of drinking, and this was a perfect opportunity to do that. I forgot to mention that the pictures around, the photographic material around the edge of that drawing shows various pubs in Britain who've taken their names from monarchs or members of royalty.
Tomb of the King's Head.
So this drawing represents the kind of chronology of the venues for drinking in Britain, kind of starting up here with the first brew houses, where mainly the women of the household would make their own beer and sell it to travellers passing through or to the local people of the village or town. And I think those were the first people to be accosted by the sheriffs and the landlord, saying maybe we could be making some money off the back of this. And that's where the first taxation of beer started. So they'd have to get licenses to start brewing this, or give a certain amount to the local landowners, often give quite a lot to the local landowners. So it kind of morphs into, you see bits of the Coliseum coming through, but they're still in the same structure. So it morphs into, one of the laws they passed was that if you ran a brew house, you had to have a sign hanging outside to advertise the fact that you're brewing beer there. But that's an aspect of social control and drink in Britain, that it's not for the, you assume it's for the benefit of the customer. They can see, oh, there's a pub, I'll go and have some beer. But I think it's really for the benefit of the landowners. You could see that this was your trade, that's what you were doing, and so you could be taxed accordingly. And it kind of morphs into the coaching inn here. This is the balcony from the coaching inn where I grew up in Cambridge, called the Eagle and the Child. And that was very much part of political life in Britain. They always had the hustings for the local elections at the inns. There's a very famous Hogarth print of Notting Hill Farm, when there's a junction at Notting Hill Gate in London where there were four pubs. I think each pub was used for canvassing votes by the various parties. And it shows people on the balcony of this coaching inn kind of accepting bribes and offering inducements to gain people's votes. But that very much became part of British travellers' life. They'd stop there and have their dinner and ale. This kind of, I think, purports to be the oldest pub in Britain, the old trip to Jerusalem in Nottingham, which is like a half-timbered place, which obviously refers to the Crusaders and Templars setting off to the Holy Land. And but the kind of gold, there's the Mayflower here, which is where the Pilgrim Fathers set off to the United States from. The old Cheshire Cheese, which is a pub on Peak Street, where Dr. Johnson used to meet. It's very much the hub of literary London, and still was in the kind of 1960s and 70s, when all of the Fleet Street journalists were known to meet there and discuss stories over lunch before passing out. And then goes through to this would be like a gin shop, as depicted in Hogarth's picture, Gin Lane, which addressed the problem of gin consumption in 18th century London as a kind of foreign threat to the British moral fibre, accompanied with his print Beer Street, which showed us the paradise of a British town where the population consumed beer rather than gin. And then we go to the Trafalgar Tavern is in Greenwich, and it goes through to the kind of the Victorian, the grand kind of Victorian pubs, which everyone's probably still familiar with now, with all of these etched glass mirrors on the walls and huge kind of handmade mahogany bars. I kind of discovered that the reason for all of this adornment and the amount of money that was spent on the pubs in the Victorian times was in part to counter the temperance movement by providing the working man with a place that he could go and kind of consume ale with his workmates. There wasn't kind of a down at heel sawdust on the floor kind of wooden shack which would have existed before. It was giving some dignity to the workers, and also I think because it cost such a lot of money to get a license to sell beer because of the legislation that was going through Parliament at the time, that to justify this, they made pubs into very valuable pieces of property.
and they go through here to the Coach and Horses, which was at the centre of the bohemian drinking culture in Soho in the 1950s and 60s, where writers such as Keith Wardhouse and Jeffrey Bernard, the journalist, would have drunk. I heard a very funny story. It was in Keith Wardhouse's obituary, where one of his friends had said to him, Keith, because the people who actually did, who worked, they weren't in the Coach and Horses all the time. They were at their desks. And the reason they were in the Coach and Horses was because they'd filed their stories or they'd finished their writing for the day. Mm-hmm. So one said to Keith Wardhouse, there was always a very funny smell in the Coach and Horses, wasn't there? He never worked out what it was. And Keith Wardhouse said, I know what it was. He said, well, what was it? Failure. But the, and then near the Coach and Horses, the French House was the headquarters of Free France during the Second World War, and it's still like a centre for kind of if there's such a thing as bohemianism anymore, for kind of writers and artists to hang out there. Mm. And then go back down to the head where depicted by the profusion of kind of cheap wine and local off licences and kind of two for one offers. I remember there was quite a scandal when petrol stations started selling liquor because of the connection between driving and drinking was made explicit there. And then I think it was on the radio yesterday that the head of Tesco's has now started a campaign where he wants the two-for-one offers to stop in supermarkets and for drink to be sold above cost price, because I looked in our local Tesco and you can get per quart beer that's cheaper than water, which is kind of unusual. I don't think such a thing has ever existed in Britain, where the drink is worth less than than tap water. But then through here is kind of like a discreet cocktail lounge, the kind of which is very popular with kind of young drinkers now, where someone will be able to apply to the council to change the use of what might have been a hardware store into a cocktail lounge. And they'll just have a counter and a few bottles behind it, and they're able to run it as a kind of social club. But I've purposefully left out, well, this is kind of the arena where all of this this binging is supposed to take place in kind of supposed gladiatorial fashion.
So it relates well as well, talking about this one and talking about the complexity of drinking culture, to the little room that we've got here as well, which we've brought together, just looking at our own collection here in Warsaw and just the drink-related items that we have. And we have an awful lot of pictures of pubs.
Yeah.
And,
that's just a section.
Pubs that have had certain histories. Yeah, that's just a section. We had a lot more than that. We had to edit down, but, so it's still it's quite a sort of rich seam to mine, isn't it?
Oh, the other thing I was going to say were these banners on the top, which are like the ones that have hung from the Colosseum, show the brand marks of the largest brewers in Britain, or drinks brand owners. But does anyone have any questions about this drawing? Thank you.
The top
right.
The only place you could buy a drink, wasn't it?
License. Yes.
But now it's...
That's changed now, yes. I think that, I mean, if there is a problem with drink in Britain, it obviously is the availability of drink. Is a very key aspect to it. The British character aside. When I was reading about places like Bulgaria, where they had a terrible problem with alcoholism, where they passed a law where it's illegal for a bar to serve you a drink unless you have a bottle of water on the table as well, which is kind of quite sensible. And the phrase binge drinking, I didn't realize it entered the French language as well. Ms. Sarkozy was speaking in Parliament
le binge drinking.
About le binge drinking. So it's an exportable commodity.
Yes. Excellent.
But this one, I did start here, and I drew it as you would a kind of a comic strip from left to right.
But no closed pubs.
No closed pubs. No. Well, pubs like
that's the thing now,
these Victorian pubs are all being transformed into restaurants or It's quite it's communities where they have these Victorian pubs, but the local people aren't the type of people who want to go and have a meal in a gastro pub. Those are the ones that are disappearing most. And the neighbourhood kind of further east from where I live is very kind of Muslim, and those communities don't use the pubs at all. So there's no, I mean, they're losing all their customers. So, you know, grand Victorian pubs in East London, they're not being destroyed, they're just being transformed into flats mainly.
Gone
Pole
on the corner of the lake, the
structure
is actually transformed into a rocky surface.
Oh, right.
It's called
Gone Pole Circle.
Which is the best way to put it on this.
Yes.
But at the centre of the suburb on Cummings Street,
because
you can
surely move off. Yeah. I think it's the price of drink that's led people to drink more at home than to use the pub. And probably the media's depiction of in Saturday night in the centre of town being a kind of not a particularly attractive place to be unless you're 16 and crazy.
Are you a teetotaler?
No, I ain't buying you. And I don't think I was. I thought, well, when I was making this drawing over here, I thought, what would it be like to just go without drink for like the month I'm making this drawing about temperance? And I realised I'm not a performance artist. It would be.
You need it for research to do your 11 stages of brokenness.
Yeah. But I don't seek inspiration in the bottle. No, it was very funny talking to journalists about. Because the lady from the RA, I went on at length to her about it not being a kind of moral inquiry, but she wanted to write about it as a moral issue because of her, I think, her own feelings towards the subject. I was trying to find, you know, precedents where people had had exhibitions about drink as a problem, but it's either, but I couldn't find any exhibitions about drink as problematic. I mean, maybe the Wellcome Institute have had similar exhibitions, but that's more about, you know, the medical aspect of alcohol.
Yeah.
And when people write objectively about alcoholism, they'll refer to it as ethanol. Say it's an addiction to ethanol, which is put in those terms, you realise how much damage you're doing to your body by the consumption of it. But that's it. That's how to write about it in an objective fashion, I think.
And we thought we'd focus on these drink-related works today, as they're the new works that are for the exhibition. But would you like to, for Adam, to say a few words about these? Do you want to come in here and you just talk about all four?
Yes.
Generally, and perhaps a few points about them. Thank you.
I'll just talk very, very briefly about the incumbent here. But the drawings in here are just more about general social themes and about kind of planned cities and just, you know, structure of society. This one, for example, I took the Statue of Liberty off Liberty Island and replaced it with this figure of a Piero from the Watteau painting called Gilles. And it was part of a series of drawings where I replaced Liberty with different figures who represented different characters that society could aspire to. So rather than Liberty, this is more like a state of melancholy as a kind of guiding principle, with kind of New York in the background there. The scaffolding is about to come down as if this figure has just replaced Liberty. Well, when I was making this, I looked at all of the plans for to have this kind of new colossus outside of Manhattan. I think at one point they wanted a Hercules figure. That's what the sculptor planned to have standing outside New York Harbor. And so this drawing I made for the cover of a magazine I do the covers for every quarter. And then Thomas Hobbes Leviathan, which is like the political thinker Thomas Hobbes, commissioned a French engraver to do the frontispiece of his book, Leviathan, and the artist represented society as the body of a king, holding the scepter and the sword, with a kind of utopia below him. The magazine I worked for is about finance and kind of luxury goods, and I mean, it's led by hedge fund managers and people in the City of London. So I had this kind of corporate figure of the the universal bank account made up of all of these suited, pen-striped figures making up these bodies, holding a checkbook and umbrella and standing over Canary Wharf, the financial district, rather than standing over this kind of rural idyll. And the picture over there is called The Dissolution of the Call Centres. That just shows a medieval type scriptoria being kind of ransacked. Like a medieval scriptoria which has been turned into a call centre. And it's being kind of overrun by these Victorian characters who are liberating the people who are working there. And then the drawings on the left are a series called the Classicist's Cookbook. And they took views of Rome that the type that Piranesi would have made, the kind of prints that would hanging in the drawing room of kind of any gentleman grand tourist. And I've kind of infiltrated these views with bomb-making recipes from the Anarchist Cookbook, which is like a kind of late 60s countercultural handbook for would-be anarchists. So the pantheon here becomes toilet, which it kind of shows a bomb. It's called a toilet bomb, where you fill the system, which is the pantheon here, with bleach, and fill the toilet bowl here, which is fountain outside, with caustic soda crystals. But when the bleach goes down the flush pipe here and combines with the caustic soda, it makes cyanide gas, and I think it can kill your victim. But the Piranesi would have explained what the various monuments were in the depictions of Rome. So rather than describe what the monuments are, I've got a list of ingredients for these bombs.
Well, I think that's enough. Are there any questions you'd like to ask Adam? I'm sure he's willing to stay around for a little while. People want to chat.
Well, thanks for your attention. I hope it's been enlightening.
Thank you very much for coming. Yeah.
Really good.
Thank you. Good.